from Pennsylvania to New Mexico, Oregon to Ohio, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, not all businesses oppose government regulation. Some use government to their competitive advantage. The Mercatus Center at George Mason University has conducted a survey. Matthew Mitchell is here with details. Three special elections will be held for seats in the U.S. House of Representatives this spring. Scott Hutchinson of the Club for Growth has the real story. If you live in Nashville and you want to record music in your own home, you would be violating the law. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Braden Busek of the Beacon Center. And the Democratic Socialists are pushing so-called Medicare for all. But on his American Radio Journal commentary, Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA says it would really be Medicaid for all. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Some businesses actually welcome government regulation when it gives them an advantage over their competitors. The Mercatus Center at George Mason University recently conducted a survey entitled A Culture of Favoritism, Corporate Privilege and Beliefs About Markets and Governments. Here to discuss results of the study is Dr. Matthew Mitchell, a senior fellow at the Mercatus Center. Matthew, welcome to American Radio Journal. Matt, before we get into results of your survey, A Culture of Favoritism, tell us a bit about the survey. What is it you were looking to study, and how did you go about doing that?
How people think about markets is really important, and economists have increasingly come to realize this. It's really a point that has gone back all the way to Adam Smith, but Joseph Schumpeter, among others, have pointed out that the way business leaders in particular think about markets is really important. If they view competition and free and open competitive markets as an important attribute, then it's going to be, and they understand exactly what that means, then markets are going to be preserved, and business leaders themselves are going to make sure that markets are preserved and they aren't undermining them. But on the other hand, if business leaders have this sort of jaundiced view of markets or don't exactly even understand what it's meant by a free market and ultimately work to undermine free markets, they themselves can be sort of the source of the death of free markets. So as Schumpeter put it, he asked, can capitalism survive? And he said, no, I don't think it can. And he thought that was because of the way business leaders themselves tended to view markets, as they often were sort of in favor of a free market in general, but not in favor of a free market for themselves. And so what we wanted to look into is exactly how business leaders think about markets. Do they think about it in a way that is going to help preserve markets, or may end up ultimately undermining them and maybe causing their death?
As we look then at results of your survey, Doctor, it appears that there might be a divergence of viewpoints, I guess, depending upon whether the business you're involved in is benefiting from government regulation or government favoritism, and whether your business is not. So give us some of the main takeaways from the survey.
That's right. The first questions we asked were whether business leaders believe that their own firms benefited from government favor or government privilege. And what we found is somewhat depressing. About two-thirds of business leaders think that, yes, their firms do benefit from some sort of special privilege or favor. And then what we did was we asked these business leaders questions about government, about markets, and about favoritism itself, and we saw how the answers to those questions correlated or didn't correlate with whether or not they believe they work for a favored firm. And some of the findings are pretty stark. So, for example, on favoritism itself, if you work for a favored firm, you're about twice as likely to think that it's proper and appropriate for government to favor particular firms, businesses, or industries. We also, though, asked them about how do you feel about markets in general. And on this, they're sort of mixed. If you work for a favored firm, you're more likely to support the free market in the abstract. But then if we ask you, okay, how about the current United States market? Is it too free and just appropriately free or not free enough? And actually, these business leaders are more likely to say that the U.S. has too free of a market, and they're less likely to say that it's not free enough. Similarly, they're more likely to support government intervention in the economy. They're more likely to support regulation. They're more skeptical of competition as well.
As you look at what's been occurring, we have obviously had a big run-up in regulation during the Obama administration. The Trump administration is scaling that back somewhat. Matt, from your perspective, studying free markets, studying the impact of government involvement on the free markets, have you seen overall a major increase in the number of businesses who are actually out lobbying and asking government to regulate or get involved in their business sector?
Yes, I think we do see that, at least documenting it over the long run. And I think this is a nuanced point that's often missed by both the advocates of markets and those who are skeptical of markets. You know, it's often characterized as those who are skeptical of markets say we need regulations to help consumers. And yeah, it might hurt businesses, but we need the regulations to help consumers. And even the defenders of free markets sort of agree with the general premise that regulations harm businesses. I think the reality is a little bit more nuanced. Regulations are rarely, you know, universally anti-business. They're, what is more common is that they are anti-some business. You know, regulations raise costs differentially across firms, across industries. Sometimes they raise costs in a way that benefits incumbent firms because they, by raising some certain costs, they can limit entry and therefore limit competition and grant some measure of anti-competitive power to incumbent firms. They can also lock in certain technologies. They can result in price floors. They can limit quantity competition or the scale competition. So there's a number of ways that regulations can actually benefit firms, but at the expense of consumers. And so I think this point is often missed. I would argue that every onerous regulation has at least one special interest that wants it. And often that is a business because it benefits them.
In terms of customers, Matt, how badly does this hurt? It would seem to me that if you have government passing regulations that favor a certain business and maybe squash another business, is this not having a long-term impact on the nation's entrepreneurial spirit, research and development, coming up with new technologies and new products? Doesn't this have a chilling effect on that?
Yeah, it does in a number of ways. So one, it can lock in older technologies simply by making sort of outlawing competition. We can see this in certain regulatory responses to the sharing economy, where, you know, entire business platforms have essentially been declared illegal by certain jurisdictions. But another and more subtle way, and I think the survey sort of gets at it, is that it can also change the behavior of business leaders. So if the way to profit is by getting cozy with government regulators or making sure you know the right people or pursuing a business model that's politically correct, then firms will orient the way that they do business around government. And so they will spend more time thinking about how to create value for policymakers rather than how to create value for customers.
We have been talking with Dr. Matthew Mitchell. He has been in charge of a new survey, A Culture of Favoritism, Corporate Privilege and Beliefs About Markets and Government. A lot of interesting results there. Doctor, if we have listeners who would like to learn more, tell us a bit about the Mercatus Center at George Mason University and where folks can go if they want to read the summary or the full survey.
The Mercatus Center is a university-based research center, and our mission is to bridge the gap between academic ideas and real-world problems. And if you want to learn more about the Mercatus Center and our mission, you can go to mercatus.org.
Matthew Mitchell of the Mercatus Center. Matthew, thank you for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. This week, we're not going to really talk about what's happening in Congress, but there are three special elections pending for seats in the United States House of Representatives. So we're going to take a look at each of those three districts. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Let's start out in Pennsylvania, my home state. Actually, a nearby congressional district. We have a vacancy in Pennsylvania 12. Why do we have the vacancy?
Well, on January 23rd, Congressman Tom Marino announced his retirement or resignation due to some health issues that he's been enduring, and it created a vacancy there for that congressional seat. So earlier this year, the Republicans in the district held a convention, and State Representative Fred Keller from Middle Creek Township in Snyder County emerged as the Republican nominee. And on May 21st, we're going to have the special election to fill the seat against a Democrat, Mark Friedenberg, who was unopposed for the Democrat nomination.
Tell us a little bit about the 12th District, Scott. Is this likely Republican retention? Is it going to be competitive? How do you see the race shaping up?
Well, we actually see Mr. Keller easily winning this race, but we really need to ensure that there's strong turnout, just because every special election is really the only game in town, and that's why it's important to make sure people show up and vote. The district is an R plus 17, and Tom Marino in November beat Friedenberg 66-34%. But we really want to discourage a future primary, because we certainly think that Mr. Keller is a strong upgrade over Congressman Marino. And earlier this week, the Club for Growth officially endorsed Keller through our Club for Growth PAC and is recommending him as the preferred candidate in the 12th Congressional District of Pennsylvania. He's had a very strong voting record in the Pennsylvania Capitol and a real fighter for economic freedom. We think that when he gets to Washington, he's sort of a no BS type of man that will hold his own against the powers that traditionally make bad things happen here in Washington.
In the case of all three of these special elections we're going to talk about on the show today, Scott, all of these are for seats that will then be up for a regular election cycle next year, correct?
That's right. They'll have to go through a normal election cycle in November of 2020, same time that the president's on the ticket. So Pennsylvania is certainly going to be front and center for our country and seeing if we can keep the state red.
Well, the 12th District certainly is in the central part of Pennsylvania, a very heavily Republican area. So we will keep an eye on the Fred Keller race in PA 12, which will be taking place, as you mentioned, in May. Let's go south now. The state of North Carolina actually is going to be home to two special elections. Let's talk first about North Carolina's 3rd Congressional District. Why the vacancy there?
Yeah, so 13-term Congressman Walter Jones, a Liberty guy, libertarian-type Republican, passed away earlier this year, creating the vacancy. What we have here is 17 different candidates. It's really a free-for-all and difficult to determine who is going to emerge on the top of the special election that's being held on April 30th. The good news is that if anybody can finish above 30% in the primary in North Carolina, they emerge as the winner. If they do not finish above 30%, the top two vote-getters will then go to a runoff election, and that's what we're mostly anticipating for both of these races. We think that the field is so big that there are a number of very solid conservatives, especially in North Carolina 3. There's probably five or six that are solid candidates, and we want to see who makes it to the runoff and then make a decision between the two.
So just to clarify, because this is a little bit of an unusual situation, in this special election, all the candidates who make ballot, they all compete at one time, both Republican and Democrat, or just Republican?
This is the Republican primary, so there would still be a general election, but we're focused on the 17 Republicans that are running right now.
So the Republican primary is April 30th, and then a potential runoff. What part of the state, Scott, is North Carolina 3 located in?
North Carolina 3 is the Outer Banks. It's the North Carolina coastline. It's got a major military base in the district. That's where Camp Lejeune is.
Moving now to the 9th Congressional District of North Carolina, where is that and what happened there that we have a vacancy?
Last November, it was a very, very tight race, and Mark Harris emerged as the victor in the general election. Unfortunately, there was election issues, and the election results were thrown out by the state, and they set a new election. Mark Harris decided not to run. And what we have there is a handful of candidates. Again, we haven't made an endorsement yet, but there's a state senator named Dan Bishop that's running, another man named Stoney Rushing, who's a county commissioner. We have another county commissioner, Matthew Ridenour, and there's a pro-life activist named Stevie Rivenbark. And then there's also a very, very moderate candidate with the last name of Brown. She's a realtor and has very significant support from the Realtors PAC.
And that district, of course, would be a toss-up district then when we move to the general, correct?
Yep. It's definitely a toss-up. The Democrat there, Dan McCready, just barely lost to Mark Harris, and he's running again. So it's going to be incredibly competitive. It used to be the seat of Congressman Robert Pittenger. It's in the Charlotte region.
We, of course, will keep a close eye on those special elections as we move forward with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization with over 250,000 members. We believe in economic freedom. We have members in all 50 states of the union. And if your listeners are interested, they can check us out on our website, www.clubforgrowth.org. And I'd also encourage them to follow us on Twitter, at Club for Growth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth. Scott, we'll check in with you again next week. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Nashville, of course, is the capital of country music. But if you wanted to record a song in your own home, well, you would be violating the law. To learn more, Eric Baim of Reason Magazine talks with Braden Busek of the Beacon Center. Eric?
Elijah Shaw moved to Nashville back in the 1990s because he wanted to study music, and indeed, what better place to do it? After spending a number of years out on the road working with record labels and musicians, kind of going wherever the work would take him, he eventually settled down and he built an in-home recording studio in a detached garage right next to his Nashville house. That has allowed him to stay at home and raise his daughter while continuing to work in one of the world's best live music scenes. But for the last 4 years, the city of Nashville has been trying to shut down Elijah's in-home recording studio because they say it violates city ordinances about running a business out of your own home. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Baim with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Braden Busek. He is the Vice President of Legal Affairs for the Beacon Center in Tennessee, and he joins us now on the phone from Nashville to talk about this case. The Beacon Center is one of a couple different law firms actually working on behalf of Elijah in his ongoing lawsuit against the city. Braden, thank you so much for taking some time and being here to talk to us today.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So Elijah's got an in-home recording studio right there in Nashville, working with all the musicians that are in and around the Nashville music scene. The city doesn't like this, though. They say he's got to shut it down. They've been trying to shut him down now for years. Well, what is it? What does the city say here? What is he doing wrong?
Yeah, it's illegal to make music in Music City. And the reason why is because Nashville enacted a prohibition on home businesses that see clients. So any sort of a business where a client comes to your home is illegal under Nashville City Code. So that means that piano lessons, tutoring, yoga instructions are illegal. It certainly means that having a home studio is illegal. And as a native Nashvillian, this offends me on a particular level because one of the cool things about Nashville is you're liable to have something like a neighbor who's a professional musician or has a home studio, and that's what makes Nashville different and great.
Yeah, Elijah is not, I mean, it's not as if he's just messing around on the side here. I mean, he's worked with legitimate artists, everybody from Jack White, who you just naturally associate with Nashville these days, Jack White to Wilco, different country recording artists. There's just such a great music culture there in Nashville. It's not just the bars on the main strip that everybody goes to listen to live music, but there really are just so many artists who live and work in and around that part of the country. And Elijah's very much a part of that. Look, it's you guys at the Beacon Center, it's our friends at the Institute for Justice, a couple of other people who are involved in this lawsuit, but it really goes beyond the question of whether Elijah's going to get to keep his in-home recording studio. Tell us a little bit more about kind of what the legal background is here and what is this law that you guys are challenging in court.
We're not asserting that the city can't enact laws prohibiting businesses from coming to residential areas. All we're saying is that certain types of businesses that only see a certain number of clients per day and don't offend noise and parking regulations should be constitutionally permitted within residential zoning. So Lidge certainly falls under that category. I mean, if anything is not going to disrupt the residential character of a neighborhood, it's a recording studio, which has to be professionally soundproofed by its very nature. So you're never going to hear Lidge if you're his neighbor.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of the great irony here, right, is that you've got this law that is probably designed to prevent lots of cars from piling up on residential streets, where if you had a business there, that might be a problem for traffic or a nuisance type situation, where if you've got a lot of people making a lot of noise, that's a problem for neighbors. This is a soundproofed music studio. It's not like he's having a big party in his backyard where the neighbors might have reason to complain about that. This is literally, he's in there with like one or two other people. It's not a typical business situation. He's not running Office Park out of his garage. But this really gets, I think, to another issue, and it touches on question about zoning laws. And this is something I think libertarians and conservatives have maybe been a little bit blind to for a little while. We're very big on property rights, obviously, but the fact, the way in which, and zoning laws in many ways are created to sort of protect property rights, but they're being used now more and more by cities to say what you can't do on your own property. And I think that kind of, that becomes a problem when you've got cities like Nashville that are enforcing this law as an issue of the zoning code. Tell us a little bit about how this sort of intersects with that broader problem.
Yeah, a lot of the ways in which cities exert control over their citizens are through zoning codes. And I don't have to tell you that, historically speaking, zoning codes are a pretty new development within American law. And they're getting more and more pervasive in terms of what they cover. It used to be that a man's home was his castle. And as long as you weren't creating a nuisance, no one could really tell you what to do within your own four walls. But increasingly, cities are using their zoning regulations to regulate and govern even the most minute of personal behavior within a home. One of the things I like to joke about this case is we like to say the government shouldn't have any role in telling people what they're doing in the privacy of their own bedrooms. Yet here we have the government telling people what they can do in their home with any room. That's just heavy-handed and unnecessary.
Well, we wish you good luck, and we wish Elijah Shaw good luck. Again, this is really a team-up effort from the Beacon Center there in Tennessee and the Institute for Justice, the national libertarian law firm that goes around whacking these types of bad governmental regulations all the time. And when they get together, good things happen, so they are working on behalf of Elijah Shaw right there in Nashville. That is Braden Buchek from the Beacon Center in Tennessee. Braden, we really appreciate you being here on the show. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Eric.
And you can check out more of their work in Tennessee at beacontn.org. That's beacontn.org. You can read more about this case and about Elijah Shaw's ongoing struggle with the city of Nashville at reason.com. We had an article this week bylined by Christian Britschke, a friend of mine, a colleague of mine. The headline there is that Music City doesn't want you making music in your own home. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can catch us right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Having renamed socialized medicine as Medicare for All, Democrat socialists are pushing hard for a new single-payer healthcare system. On this American Radio Journal commentary, Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA says it would end up as Medicaid for All. Colin?
The Democratic free-for-all for their party's presidential nomination next year is a fascinating contest in which rhetoric rules over reason, pandering rules over policy, and demagoguery rules over democracy. The old saw that in politics, perception is everything is being borne out in every news story on the campaign that isn't about fundraising. The lack of realism is both remarkable and profoundly dangerous, because there's a reasonable likelihood that the eventual Democratic Party nominee will defeat Donald Trump next November and become our president. In that vast, overheated cauldron of grandiloquence, one issue has emerged as what the Inside the Beltway newspaper roll call calls the defining issue of this campaign, and that is Medicare for All. That phrase was first coined by socialist Senator Bernie Sanders in 2015, and his updated version has been endorsed by at least four of the 2020 contenders, Senators Warren, Gillibrand, Harris, and Booker. It is an example of the absolute worst of American politics, a financially irresponsible and utterly unfeasible pitch that is designed cynically to prey on voters' gullibility without proposing any genuine solutions. It is also deceitfully named. It's nothing like Medicare for All. It's much closer to Medicaid for All. In an especially insightful comment, Roll Call says that Medicare for All is, quote, more likely to be litigated on the campaign trail than in the halls of Congress, close quote. Its proponents evoke comparisons with the civil rights and women's movements by saying that free health care is also a right. Then they demean the health care industry's for-profit players, hospitals, doctors, and insurance companies, implying that profit is essentially a diversion of funds from serving the needs of patients to serving the needs of corporations and their investors. They display an ignorance or a denial of one of the primary social benefits of a profit-based free enterprise system over socialism, namely that a competitive and profit-based market actually reduces prices rather than increasing them. Senator Sanders is aware of what a fundamental issue he is debating because he said, quote, "What we are involved in is not just health care legislation. We are involved in a great struggle. This is a struggle for the heart and soul of who we are as the American people," close quote. He's right about how significant the struggle is, but he's squarely on the wrong side of that struggle. Let's look at two aspects of what I like to call the Sanders swindle. First, the cost, and second, why it's more like Medicaid for all than Medicare for all. One of the most detailed estimates of the cost of the Sanders swindle is the Urban Institute, who predicted that the increase in total cost would be so great that it would equal or exceed the entire defense budget, driving total health care costs to nearly 22% of our entire economy. Is Medicare for All an honest name for the Sanders, Warren, Gillibrand, Harris, Booker plan? National Review magazine says no. Here's their analysis. Quote, "Medicare for All promises free health care, meaning no out-of-pocket costs for patients. Medicaid provides that benefit now, but Medicare doesn't. Beneficiaries under Medicare are responsible for about 50% of their health care bills. Sanders' bill would outlaw all private health insurance, including policies offered by employers, privately purchased, and even Medigap plans," close quote. Most troubling to seniors who prefer the non-government option called Medicare Advantage, where seniors opt out of federal Medicare and instead contract with a private insurance company for health coverage in place of Medicare, that would also disappear. The National Review concludes by saying, quote, "Medicaid is a mess, with many doctors refusing to participate due to low payment schedules. Beneficiaries often face lines and delays in treatments. Such difficulties will surely worsen if we are all forced into a one-size-fits-all government program," end quote. That's what the Sanders swindle offers. Healthcare rationing, long waiting lists, discouraged doctors dropping out of the system, hospitals going broke, and a radical slowing down of research and development of new drugs. The question is, will American voters demand rigorous analysis of so-called free health care, or will they fall for it because free sounds so good? This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal. Visit us on the web at letfreedomringusa.com.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliate, WJNI-FM in Charleston, South Carolina. Welcome to our new listeners in the Palmetto State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.